Okay, thank you everyone for joining us here today. This session is a panel and open discussion on new archival approaches to the history and memory of Atlantic world slavery. So I'm going to pass it on to the presenters to introduce themselves.
Well, thanks so much for having us here. It's really delightful to be back in the kind of clear Mellon orbit, a place that I so much enjoyed. I think it was 11 years ago now. I'm Matthew Fox Amato. I'm an associate professor of history at the University of Idaho. And I am very, very excited to introduce the two professors that I will be speaking with today on this panel. And I think what I'll do is I'll introduce people in the order in which they're going to speak, and then I'll let them take it from there. So the first speaker we have is Dr. Danielle Terrazas-Williams, who is lecturer of the Global South in the School of History at the University of Leeds. Her research has appeared in the Americas, Journal of Women's History, and History of Religions, and has been recognized with multiple awards. She has held fellowships at Princeton and Huntington Library, and her recently published book, The Capital of Free Women, Race, Legitimacy, and Liberty in Colonial Mexico, was just released by Yale University Press in April 2022. So we're having both a panel and kind of a book party, I think also, you know, a month old, very exciting. And this is a book that challenges traditional narratives of racial hierarchies and gendered mobility. Next up is Dr. Scott Heerman, who's a scholar of 18th and 19th century US history. His first book, The Alchemy of Slavery, Human Bondage and Emancipation in the Illinois Country, was published in 2018 by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Heerman is in the preliminary stages of a second book project, provisionally entitled Carried Back, Black Kidnapping in the Age of Atlantic Emancipation, which looks at Black kidnapping in the hemispheric Caribbean from the age of revolutions through the era of emancipation. Heerman has received many grants and fellowships from places including the Library Company, the Huntington, the William Clements Library at Michigan, and his articles have appeared or are forthcoming in Slavery and Abolition, Early American Studies, the Journal of the Early Republic, and the Journal of Illinois History. And as I said, I'm Matthew Fox Amato. I published a book called Exposing Slavery, Photography, Human Bondage, and the Birth of Modern Visual Politics in America with Oxford in 2019. And I'm currently working on two projects, just throw that out there. The first examines the memory of US slavery in different forms of visual culture. And the second, a little bit of a different field, is looking at the history of the White House photographer. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Williams to start the show.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for your time today as you hopefully join us in this wonderful conversation about slavery studies and archival practice and engaging with some really challenging materials in a very tenuous time. And so thank you again for being here today. So I just wanted to offer a little bit of an overview of my book before offering also a case study from it. So my book, The Capital of Free Women, Race, Legitimacy, and Liberty in Colonial Mexico, it follows the stories of a number of different women across the 17th century, as well as part of the 18th century. So just about 1580s to 1730s. This is a book that focuses on different aspects of capital, whether it be social, so sort of who you know, cultural, what you know, and economic, sort of what you have. It ranges a great spectrum of people who are recently manumitted, but also those who are heirs of intergenerational wealth. So a very wide spectrum of free Black women who I focus on. Sometimes their proximity to slavery is very clear. Some women talk about how their mothers were enslaved. Some women are fighting for their children to gain their freedom. Some women have owned slaves in their families for multiple generations. And so again, quite a wide spectrum that I focus on, but I want to think about navigating legal culture specifically within the context of the Notorial Archive, which was the base of my work. I looked at lots of different other archives, parish archives, viceregal archives, but the Notorial Archive is sort of the heart of the story, and so I wanted to begin. A notorial truth was often only a kind of truth. It was not unheard of for elite members of Spanish America to forge documents and to present false witnesses to alter their life stories. Free Black women also recognized the pliability of this venue and constructed notorial lives that best suited their needs. In one particularly fascinating case from my book, one woman's husband might have foiled her attempts to craft the notorial life that she wanted documented. Free mulata Mariana Rodriguez and her free mulatto husband, Miguel Jimenez Carrilero, had dozens of entries in the Notorial Archive chronicling their prominence in Jalapa, Veracruz, which is the site of the book. Now, central to Miguel's presentation of his and his wife's legacy was that he lacked wealth and that Mariana could not even offer a dowry when they wed. However, he triumphantly professed in his 1712 will that he and his wife had worked tirelessly to establish a fortune totaling 11,000 pesos through their 200 mule pack train business, but also through slaves, other property, furniture, and jewelry. Miguel seemed to want to affirm that his current wealth belied a central truth about his relationship with his wife. The two contracted the marriage from humble beginnings and with no financial gain to be had by either party at the time, a true partnership of love. However, in Mariana's 1725 will, she appeared to revise this narrative by asserting that when she married Miguel, she brought with her 100 pesos. This alteration of Mariana's history, while 100 pesos wasn't a large dowry, it was still a significant amount of money. So this alteration was a notorial narrative that better suited the station in life that she and her husband had accomplished over the years, but perhaps not the one reflected in her actual history. Or perhaps she had forgotten that her husband had already notarized their notorial truth, or perhaps Miguel was the one who constructed the notorial fantasy as the patriarch of a self-made family who built a transportation business from nothing without the resources of a rich spouse or her family, and that he would leave this world a wealthy man because of his and his wife's own Herculean efforts. Whose notorial narrative was closer to the truth? Both versions are imbibed with gendered investments and class understandings of industrious men and respectable women with dowries. Mariana Rodriguez and Miguel Jimenez Carrilero were both free mulatos who owned land, a profitable business, and slaves. They also managed professional relationships with elite members of society from Jalapa, Veracruz, and even Mexico City. Perhaps Mariana refused to let her husband mar their social status with his accounting of their modest beginnings, given her current position in society, and amended the notorial truth. But importantly, by and large, free Black women had less opportunity to reveal their economic histories in archival sources, leading for some historians to assume, to make assumptions about free women based on master-slave relations, even if these women had been free for multiple generations. And what I try to do in my book, The Capital of Free Women, is to reorient the realm of possibilities for the histories of women who navigated expectations of their lineages in a society that's still invested in slavery. Thank you very much. Was I able to stop the share? Okay, great.
Great. So thank you, of course, for this invitation today to present. And I cannot see my notes at the same time. So, well, I know mostly what I'm going to say.
Would you like me to share my screen?
No, that's okay.
I can get your notes if you need to, or your slides if you need.
That's okay. I just can't not full screen it for some reason. But anyway, 2 years in and we're still doing this, my apologies. So mostly what I want to say today is thank you to Matt for organizing this, and thank you to CLEAR for what was an extremely generative time in my academic life. That we can maybe open this up and respond to some of what Mark said in the previous session, stuff that I'm still taking with me, passing on to students, turning over as I go on to other projects. It's really a skill set I've brought with me. So that's sort of the main reason I'm here, is to reconnect with what's a great community of scholars. But what I want to do is talk, perhaps not surprisingly, about my first book project, The Alchemy of Slavery, and about the archives I encountered while I was researching it. So the book very briefly looks at the history of slavery and freedom in Native, French, British, and then US territory. And Illinois was part of all of these different national and imperial formations over the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, which is sort of the rough chronology that the book spans. I want today to talk mostly about the US period, though, because in this sort of critical hinge between the multi-imperial 18th century and the sort of mono-imperial 19th century, there's a major important development in Illinois, and that is slavery becomes illegal by terms of the 1787 Northwest Ordinance. But one of the things that I try to say in the book that I've gotten a lot of pushback about, really, by US scholars, is we should treat the Northwest Ordinance just like we treat the Code Noir, just like we treat the Siete Partidas, that because a distant empire issued a set of laws, it doesn't mean that's how it played out on the ground. So I want to use an example from this period to think through this. And really, what I also want to do is think through the archival turn in the study of slavery, right? Work by Marissa Fuentes, Ann Stoller, Catherine Burns, and many others have helped us think about the archive as a subject, not a source, right? That have impelled us to think about the context under which documents are produced, helping to shape their meaning, right? But really, very often, when we think about those archives, we think about these places, right? Mark talks about a place of adventure, and here I am, right? We think about Q. We think about the Archivo General de las Indias. We think about the Archivo Histórico Nacional. We think about Aix-en-Provence. In Stoller's case, we think about The Hague, right? We think about big imperial imposing places, the U.S. National Archives, in my instance, right? And there we see these very neat narratives, right? We see these impressive dossiers written by colonial administrators, written by notaries, professional men, to make documents legible either to Atlantic audiences or imperial higher ups. But the US settler empire actually works very differently, because the nodes of government in the US settler empire and the nodes that are creating paper in the US settler empire are county courthouses. The places today that you go to pay parking tickets, pay property taxes, record deeds, do any of that work, these are actually archival repositories. They are sites of government, which means they generate documents. And when we think seriously about how the US empire works in the 19th century, these are imperial spaces, which really look radically different than what the literature that Fuentes and Stoller are producing. So if we take this seriously as an imperial archive and as a node of a settler empire, what we end up getting is a very different set of documents. Documents that look like this. Documents that are not created even by notaries, to say nothing of colonial administrators. Gone are the neat narratives that create a legible story about subordinated populations and suppress and silence them in the archives. The notion that a foreign secretary or a cabinet officer or a politician is ever going to see this document is really laughable. These are intensely local sources. And what we can do then is get documents like this, which are all across Southern Illinois, which is what I researched. And we can get people like Linda, who is here signing an indenture. She's an enslaved woman being turned into an indentured servant for 99 years, right? And part of what this document can do then is tell me something about Linda or Judith or any of the other enslaved people in Illinois who are being converted into indentures as an end run around the abolition laws. But they also can tell me about the alchemy of slavery, right? They can also tell me about the larger imperial forces that are at work that allow this document to exist. So on the one hand, my first instinct when I was doing this research was to treat this like a social historian would, right? here's Linda. We know something about her age. We know something about where she's from. We can quantify indenture times, right? This was my first instinct. But if we think of this as an imperial document, we also need to ask a whole lot of other questions about the discursive landscape that they exist in, about the racial logic that the US empire is trafficking in, and how that's different than the logics of racism in other empires. We need to really think about this moment of the alchemy of slavery, not just telling us something about Linda, but telling us something about the larger imperial forms that she's caught up in, right? A methodological move that's very familiar in places like Q or AGI. Ultimately then, and I'll conclude because I'm going over on time, but ultimately for me, this makes me think a lot about the stories of silencing, right? And think about the stories of erasure that are very common in this literature that I think are very serious and I think are on point. This actually tells us a story of presence, right? This tells us a story of possibility. It's, I think, very telling that I could go into a county courthouse in a nominally free state, 18 of them all told, and find documents about enslaved people or lifelong indentures in every last one of them, right? And so I think we have to somehow think about the silencing in the archives and the erasure in the archives as two slightly different things, and maybe create some reading practices around the problem of erasure and different ones around the questions of silencing and repression. But that's sort of where I'll end, because I think my other co-panelists will have very interesting things to say about this as well.
All right, can everyone see that? Great. Thanks so much, Scott and Danielle, for those great sort of samplers of your bigger projects. I'm excited to talk just a little bit today about Exposing Slavery, which is a book that asks two fundamental questions. How did photography shape the history of slavery? And then in turn, how did the history of slavery shape photography? And I pursue these questions by looking at how different historical actors took up the medium and used it for different political purposes. I look at how enslavers used photography. I look at how enslaved people themselves used photography, largely to shape their social ties. I look at how abolitionists took up the medium to build their movement and mobilize opposition to bondage. And then my project ends at the Civil War, and I really hone in on how photography gave different historical actors a way to envision potential racial futures in the US. So it's a project that goes from 1839 to 1865 and explores it in those ways. Today, what I wanted to do is really focus on the archive and talk a little bit about some of the challenges I encountered and strategies I used to try and fuse the history of slavery with the history of photography. And what I want to do is focus on photographs of enslaved people, which were commissioned by enslavers. And these forged the first chapter of my book. Some of these images currently sit in the same archival boxes as slaveholders' written materials. Some are held in private hands, owned by descendants of slaveholders and collectors of early photography. Some are in locations unknown, but still described in written sources. Enslavers in cities and on farms and plantations made these photographs in Richmond and Charleston, but also places like, you know, the Panhandle region of Florida. The images themselves reveal individual slaves, such as Moses, who was enslaved in Charleston, as well as enslaved people posing with white enslavers, as in the case of the cover image of Lydia, who is really the center of this image, with her enslaver, one of her enslavers, Charlotte Middleton, there in the pink dress. The photographs show enslaved people who never fled. They show enslaved people who ran away and then were later on pictured. They show enslaved people who ran away after they were pictured. So part of the point I'm trying to make here is that it's a diverse archive in many respects. How, when I was kind of researching these, you know, I wanted to know, did they shed new light on the politics and the power dynamics of antebellum slavery? These photographs, they presented particular challenges for me as I was in the archive. Perhaps most significantly, there is so often so little contextual information surrounding photographs of Black Americans in the 19th century. Sometimes, as you can see up here, these images would come with little handwritten notes that were sometimes tucked into the cases that you can open, like a book from early photographs, as in the case of Mammy Kitty, who was enslaved in Richmond. Sometimes one finds images in big photograph collections, not in slaveholders' archival papers, that suggest enslaved status, but offer few leads for further research. This is a carte de visite from a massive collection of African-American photography at the Beinecke Library at Yale, which, as you can see on the back, says a Southern slave. And yet, of course, there was no way of knowing who wrote that, whether it was true or not. But you kind of find these details that can also sometimes be dead ends. Despite these challenges for research, I came to realize that contextualizing these images was so important to illuminate how they operated in their world rather than ours. Surrounding written sources underscored these photographs as rhetorical objects that constructed a violent world as a benevolent one. Take the example of this image, an enslaved boy named Captain on the right, and a child from the slaveholding family, Louis, on the left. The image is held at the Gibbs, and yet a trove of letters that contextualize it are held at Duke's special collections. These letters make abundant and clear how much Captain's well-dressed appearance within the frame belied his treatment outside it. For instance, during the Civil War, Captain moved from Gowrie Plantation, which was just outside Savannah, to Macon, Georgia, with his slaveholding mistress, Fanny Manigo. Fanny corresponded with her husband during this time, and at one point complained of Captain's behavior. When Louis Manigo, this is the father, the owner, responded, he suggested two options. If Fanny wanted to send Captain back to Gowrie Plantation, Louis would have the overseer, quote, lock him up in the plantation darkroom for 2 weeks and feed him on hominy and water. Alternatively, Fanny might keep Captain in Macon jail and, quote, have him well flogged at the Macon jail. So my work tries to take into account this social history that surrounds the photographs. It tries to understand their visuality. I'm happy to talk more about those points. What I wanted to end with, I'm afraid I'm already over time in a panel that I organized, which is like, you know, terrible. I'm sorry. I've got one more page. It's like 2 minutes. So I think we got plenty of time. But the other thing I wanted to say is I also try and treat these photographs as three-dimensional objects. Not just aesthetic objects, but objects that were portable, that moved in the world, that had social lives. I'm invested in understanding how they were produced, how they were exchanged, how they were circulated, how they were preserved. Sometimes that was quite difficult in understanding those social lives of photographs. Other times you find the photographs were actually pasted onto paper in various forms, in the form of want ads like Dolly on the left, in the form of family record books like Moses on the right. Locating written evidence about a specific photograph was undoubtedly needle in a haystack research. And so one of the things I tried to do for photographs that didn't come with accompanying written information, like these two, for instance, was to still use letters and diary entries that could testify to the broader cultural dynamics at work, even if I didn't have the photograph. And so I want to end with this example. It's a piece of a letter that comes from Edward Pringle, who is from an enslaving family in Charleston in the mid-1850s. Edward Pringle moved to San Francisco to practice law. And in one letter in the mid-1850s, he wrote back to his mother to thank her for sending photographs from Charleston to San Francisco by mail. And he went on at length about a photograph of Mac, who was an enslaved butler in the Pringles' Charleston townhome. And here's what he says about Mac. "And old Mac, how magnificent he is. I have laughed over him a dozen times. I keep him in the office that I may exhibit him as a specimen of the institution. How natural the old fellow looks. What a magnificence of white cravat and white pants, gold studs, gold ring, etc. Tell him his white cravat is a miracle, that there is nobody so well dressed in California." There's a lot we could say about this passage. The two things I'll highlight right now is first, the exhibit him as a specimen of the institution. Here, clear evidence of the ways in which these photographs were used as propaganda, not as mass culture, but instead in these smaller social settings like Pringle's law office. The other thing I'll highlight is the part where he says, "I've laughed over him a dozen times." And that was an interesting theme I saw throughout white responses to Black people's images. There was a kind of both elevation and subordination taking place. And in my book, one of the things I do is interpret these as a kind of condescension towards these images of often well-dressed enslaved people, a suggestion saying that while, you know, you are wearing the clothes to occupy a certain social station, you can never actually occupy that station. A couple of things going on there, I think. And as I end, I want to pose the question, what does the study of the photographic archive tell us about the history of slavery? And what I want to suggest is that it's not simply a way to use new sources to kind of enliven old stories or old arguments, but instead offers us new ways to think about how racial power and culture were intertwined in the 19th century. As I've sort of gestured towards today, enslavers through photography crafted what I call a quiet habit of domination, which is the routine use of photographs of Black people to justify exploitation, build white identity, and construct white supremacist networks. Thank you. All right, I'm gonna put on my moderator hat now and start the conversation. So one of the things, and we all have talked a little bit about this already, that I think could be useful to talk about as this bigger group convenes is the issue of both silence and presence. And you know, it was interesting. I thought Scott talked a little bit about that in his talk. Of course, studies of slavery and race and racism have rightly considered the implications of the unevenness of the silences in the archive. But you know, as I've read your books and heard your talks, I have also been really struck by this issue of presence. Danielle, you know, it's remarkable to see your work uncovering these records from the notarial archive in Jalapa. Scott, you mentioned in your talk this issue of recognizing the presence of enslaved people in the U.S. Imperial Archive. Certainly, I'm invested in understanding the oftentimes little recognized presence of enslaved people, free African Americans like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, but enslaved people in the South also in the photographic archive. And I was wondering if we might talk a little bit about this issue of both silence and presence in your work. And maybe we might start by just talking about how, you know, you've approached those issues.
I'm happy to start. Thank you again for helping moderate us. I do appreciate your efforts, Matt. One of the things that we've thought a lot about in slavery studies is, especially for Afro-Latin America, is this idea of, are we past presencia studies? Essentially, like, you know, are we done with just, you know, having works produced, historic works produced, just about the presence of people? And I think that there was a moment where there were more of these discussions. And I was on a panel a couple of years ago at the AHA where I sort of pushed back, you know, with my own work. It's like, no, I don't think that we're there. Not when I still encounter people, even throughout the academy, let alone the general public, that are not aware of the fact that, you know, Mexico was second only to Brazil in the importation of African slaves up until the end of the 17th century. And so we can't be past presencia. We're not past presence. if I'm still having those conversations, if I have to set that framework every time I present my material. And so, or just happen to have a conversation with people and say, you know, what do you study? And I talk about the fact that I study free African descended women in 17th century or long 17th century in Mexico. And sometimes the response back is like, oh, so you focus on enslaved women. And even then, it's almost this cognitive dissonance as I'm offering my material, saying these are actually free women. Sometimes they own slaves. Sometimes they're only recently freed, and sometimes they're multi-generationally have had that status. So the question of even presencia studies is really crucial, I think, to push back against, especially when we're talking about marginalized people. Perhaps there are some fields in our discipline that, you know, we can move beyond just focusing on the presence. But for those of us who focus on marginalized people, especially thinking about people of African descent, indigenous people, women that, no, I don't think the historiography has quite hit the tipping point of being tired of just presencia. So that's something that I wanted to note. But as we've sort of had a couple of discussions about the archive and confronting questions of whether questions of access to the archive and almost sort of having to convince the gatekeepers that there are materials that are very rich. And even if I would always tell people, they would say, you're not going to find any history of Black people here. And I would just sort of, I had a bit of a script at a certain point of saying, even if I just find one woman, wouldn't that be nice? And so even sort of the affect of, I know it sounds like a silly project, but if I can find one lady, then, you know, wouldn't it be lovely? Thinking about even strategies to archival access is something that, I talk to my students about all the time. Fighting for access, but also being able to get in there and to offer presencia, present studies, is a worthwhile and significant contribution. Not everything is going to be methodological. Not everything is going to be a theoretical contribution. So I tell my students, if you find, a significant historical figure that you want to focus on, that significant historical figure could be someone who just, who owned a shop, and work that history as best as you can. As I said, even if you only find one person. So I think what's great about being a historian at this moment is that we're part of a generation that appreciates that more. So we're not sort of fighting many of those similar battles as far as even things like publications. So it's nice to be in the moment.
I echo all of that. I think that's dead on. And just a couple of responses to that. One is about access, right? Like, I am in the middle, and I used in my clear year, and I'm in the projects now in the middle of, multi-sited, as we all are. Go to multiple different archives. We get sources from multiple different places. And I'm very aware that I can get stuff from the US National Archives at a scale and pace and cost that allows me to move through just an unbelievable amount of paper there that I simply cannot do in Madrid. I mean, it is just a different, to say nothing of Havana, to say nothing of Puerto Rico, to say nothing of Mexico City, right? Actually, the SRE archives in Mexico City are extremely well organized and they're very efficient. So I take them out. But right, there's simply an imbalance there. Getting to these courthouses in Southern Illinois is a very different proposition than going to the Newberry Library, right? And I think one of the things that I had to think through with CLEAR is, okay, you're there, you have access, as in you can get in the door. And Mark was great at teaching you what to do once you get in the door. I mean, that's actually very, very formative for me. But you can't read those sources the same way, right? I mean, fine, they're both written documents about, you know, an enslaved person, but they're very different repositories. There's very different access to these sources. There's very different relationships that people have with these sources. The historiography has incorporated some of these sources and has not incorporated others. And that's all stuff you have to take into account. So I agree with you, Danielle. It is about presence, but it's also to tell those stories about presence, you also need access. And that comes down to the institutions that are the custodians and the bibliographic scholars that catalog and make access possible. And that's extremely uneven. It just is. You know, the second thing to the starting question about, you know, silence and presence is, you know, I think about a woman who I actually don't write much about in the book, but it's a relatively well-known case of this woman named Pelagie Amoureux. She's, you might guess, in the Mississippi River Valley when the French are colonizing that region in the sort of late 18th century. And she lives quite long into the 19th century, into the 1850s, where she's registering as a free African-American woman, right? Well, she certainly didn't think of herself as African-American in the period before the US was there, right? That she's called Negro or French Negro doesn't mean that she's Francophone and doesn't mean that she's of African descent. If you look at the enslaved population, she could easily have familiar relationships with Apache Indians trafficked from the plains, with enslaved people the British brought in from Jamaica, so it would be Protestant and Anglophone, right? The US archive calls her a French Negro. And so at the one document that allows me to figure out she's there, like Linda, who I talked about in the presentation, is also making completely opaque some of the deeper experiences of her life, parts of her identity, how she would talk, what vocabulary around freedom she would use. It becomes completely inaccessible to me. And so there, I think the literature on silencing is incredibly important. I don't know what I would do without it. So I think it would be an enormous mistake to put these two things in tension. I think we can at once recognize, I mean, I love Danielle in your talk, you talked about the possibilities of the archive, right? The possibilities of creating notarial lives and notarial truths. And at the same time, understand we need a whole lot of reading practices to understand how we can engage with those possibilities and when we simply can't, right? So I think a lot actually about this woman and a lot of other people saying, you know, what languages does she speak to her children in? I just don't know. What does she consider to be a birth language and a mother tongue for her? She's written about in the US archives in certain ways, but I can't take that at face value. So I think in balancing those two things, I think it's less, I see them less in conflict. Oh, sometimes they are, but more as sort of really productively in dialogue, giving us different resources based on access to sources and then based on the people whose lives we want to know and never really quite will.
And I think, I mean, it feels like one of the things that's on the table here is if we move beyond silence to talk about presence, then what types of presences are we talking about? What types of presences are afforded through the sources rather than just saying silence or presence? And that's one of the reasons I love, you know, both your work. And, you know, I've certainly thought about this too. And I also had experiences in the archive that were, I think, shaped by people's familiarity with what the history of slavery looks like. And it is not typically in their imagination one in which enslaved people were going to photograph studios. And so I might show up and ask them if they had any photographs. And some people knew like the one photograph that they had in the archive. And other people just said, huh. And so then I had to think about other questions, like, you know, what photographs do you have? Do you have photographs of Black people? Things of that nature that could lead me down that road. And so I think that's one thing. Then the other thing is this issue of if we're interested in questions about, say, experience, what types of presences do those sources reveal? For me, I think connecting the history of slavery and photo history opened up questions about not just the history of self-representation and the representation of others, but also the ways in which photographs and images were used to create networks. I talked a little bit about that Pringle example earlier. Elsewhere in my work, I look at how enslaved people themselves, though dramatically poor as a social class, some had small amounts of money and they were able to purchase their own photographs. And one of the things that they did, and one can see this in slave narratives and other written records, is they used photographs to maintain social ties with one another. And so here was an instance in which, if we're thinking about presence, it was the ways in which they were actually connected to the transformations and media taking place in the 19th century, and then actively using them for their own purposes. And I don't know if anyone else wants to talk a little bit more about this issue, or if we want to keep moving on to another question. What do y'all think?
I'll just add a concluding note, perhaps. One of the things that I have grown incredibly comfortable with, especially focusing on a time period that is understudied in a place that is lesser known, is I've become quite comfortable with sort of hedging the narrative. Perhaps she considered, she might have thought. And I think that there, you know, Jessica Marie Johnson said this really beautifully at a conference I was at with her, where she said, you know, this idea of completeness is really, you know, it's sort of not what we're chasing. And I found that to be true in my own work, that this completeness is really not something that's accessible to me, that my work will not look like, you know, the works of, for example, even my wonderful colleagues who do work in the US in 19th century, you know, free women, that our stories will look different, you know, compared to those I work with on the 16th and 17th centuries. And that's okay. And that, you know, I'm not here to know exactly what they thought and how, you know, what all informed their choices, but to offer again a realm of possibilities. And so I think that's the most important thing I've learned throughout my career, is to just be comfortable with that, even if it doesn't read as others might anticipate. But they've also not read, you know, not heard their stories before. So if it's something new that they have to get used to, or it's not the type of history that they're used to, we'll think about the historical actors that you have to work with, and the archive is going to be very, very different, especially across Latin America. Very low literacy rates. There are no newspapers yet. Very few people, even wealthy people, could read or write significantly. So it just is going to look and feel differently, I think. But I'm quite comfortable with that now. So I'm thinking about how to work with those silences and be okay with them.
Just one more rejoinder on that. Because for me, I also went through a huge process of not making the mistake that you still don't ask the question or center the man or enslaved woman in the story, right? And that I, far too long, was like, well, I never really will know, so maybe I'll like fit this in, but the story's about something else. And it's a huge mistake to allow that barrier to then frame the question you ask, whose experiences you center, what you shine the focus on. And I think it's so important what you just said, Danielle, because I think we all have to not just be okay with it, but also not let it inhibit the work we want to do or the questions we want to ask.
Does anyone, I notice we have about 3 minutes left. Does anyone in the audience want to jump in and join the conversation?
I'll jump in, if I may. It's good to see all of you again. I want to thank you all for sharing your work. I really appreciate this conversation. I think at a very fundamental level, I'm struck by sort of the distinctions between these kinds of sources. Particularly, I'm thinking about, you know, Danielle's notarial records, like, which sit in notarial collections, which are designed to be sort of records for the notaries themselves, right? And often, if you're, I assume, you know, the records in Jalapa probably haven't moved much, versus the photographs, right, which are intended to be mobile, which are intended to move across space. I'm struck by, and also Scott's records too. I mean, and Scott, you spend so much time sort of following these stories around really the Atlantic world. I'm just struck by those notions there about how these types of sources are so different yet deeply fundamentally connected. And they're connected by, in this context, just thinking about the lives of enslaved peoples around the Atlantic world, early Americas and the like. So I just want to acknowledge that and say that I really appreciate that and thinking about sort of the social life, if you will, about these kinds of sources and how you're approaching them now. If I could ask, you know, we spent a little bit of time here in the last session talking about sort of the history of this program. And I wonder, since we have the three of you here talking about this and some of your early work was shaped by this program, I wonder about how you're training scholars now, as you think about your own work and what you're sort of pushing your own students and I'll say colleagues too, in terms of your own research methodologies. I mean, Scott, you noted sort of about centering the voices of the enslaved people, particularly enslaved women. Just sort of an open-ended question about reflections, about methods, practices, as we think about the future of this kind of research.
I'll do a couple real quick. Some of these come from Mark, and a lot of it is logistics. Like, a lot of it is, if you need to do laundry in a sink, how can you still look professional in an archive? Like, I mean, this is an actual thing that I think of as an instance of that. I was washing stuff in a sink and I have to go into the archives. And so just like, you can never have too many flash drives. You can never like have a physical, no one's going to steal this. Someone might steal a laptop. So have it written down somewhere where it's safe, right? I mean, just all of this stuff taught me how to what? No, he didn't teach me how to do laundry, but he talked about very logistical things, like how do you dress? Like, don't look like you've just come out of a Brooks Brothers catalog while walking into some of these archives, right? So it's logistics, it's information management. Like, do not take 9 million photographs and just let them sit there for months on end. I jump up and down saying that. Like, I really want you taking a day, a week, working on databases and controlling what you have. And I know that feels like wasted time because you're not in the reading room, but it's actually how you make the reading room effective. And then the final one, and this is the one that I'm really pushing on that I really think the literature needs to be better about, is honesty about access, right? We simply have richer institutions and poorer institutions. That will lead to imbalances in our projects. You will simply find, I just have the ability to get stuff because of concordances and all sorts of archival reorganization at some of these bigger, well-funded imperial archives compared to local ones. And we are simply kidding ourselves if we think, when telling a big Atlantic story or even now a big global story, that there isn't a real archival imbalance there around access unless we work doggedly, doggedly, doggedly to correct for it. It's not to say that we can't, but it's you know, a month in DC simply gets you more paper than a month in even London, quite honestly. So those are the three things, and I want to hear others, so I'll pipe down.
Yeah, maybe I'll talk a little bit about, you know, when I talk to students about researching photo history in particular, one of the things that I really stress is that they actually have to go to the archive, that this is not just a project that's going to think about visuality. And, you know, because I'll talk to people from different disciplines about this. And, you know, I try and do that in my work, which is like, don't just rely on the photos and kind of make this project about your imaginings of, you know, what the photos show or what the person was thinking. And in my work, I'm trying to be cautious about going too far in terms of sort of speculating about what this photo shows in terms of someone's interiority. And that means you got to dig. It really does in the 19th century. That means, you know, some of your research isn't going to be photograph collections, but most of your research is going to be in letters and diaries. And you're going to need to do what you can to understand these, how these photographs actually lived in the world. And you know, I think one of the real innovations that has helped is now you can do keyword searches. And so I would plug in every kind of word that people use for photograph in the mid-19th century and all the crazy spellings they use for daguerreotype. And there were like 15 of them. And so I would sit in an archive first and I would just type daguerreotype, daguerreotip, daguerreotope, you know. And every once in a while, I actually did get hits. And I couldn't have done that in the 1990s. Or, you know, it was incredibly helpful to have that. So I guess, you know, my point for them all is, if even if it is a visual project, it's also going to be very much research and written records.
Yeah, I think a couple of notes that I, you know, have gathered over the years and I've shared with my students. Well, you know, I have very sincere conversations with my students, whether they're undergraduates, master's students, or doctoral students, about the fact that you may not be welcomed. And I think that's a really hard thing to consider, is that you've worked really hard and you've studied and you've read all these books and you feel ready to go and you've got your clear melon felon, you know, money and you're set. And that it might be a hostile situation depending on a number of reasons, because of your gender, because of your race, because of your age. They may perceive you as less serious because if you're younger presenting, you know, you might encounter sexual harassment, as I did as well. And so I think that there are, you know, you have to have these conversations with your students. I think about, you know, how my work was shaped by one, you know, what was left out by one particular site where I didn't feel safe anymore as a woman because of comments that sort of one of the gatekeepers had made. And I think if you don't talk about these things, you know, and prepare our students, again, at any level, it's really a great disservice because, you know, we have to think about contingencies with our archival practice and knowing that there are things that are going to be sometimes uncomfortable. You may receive hostility, you may receive, you know, just outright discrimination. But I would also say that, you know, I talk to students about, you know, what are those what are your contingency plans, just so that we have those open conversations. But I don't think it's easy. I've had people say, well, we don't want to scare our students. And I was like, well, you also don't want them left out there without resources. Because if you tell them, you know, what's the possibility that something bad might happen? Maybe you don't know the resources that are available to you, especially if you're in a foreign country. You know, who do you reach out to if something like this starts happening, where you're discriminated against by any measure of discrimination, right? So I think having serious conversations about what it means to present yourself before gatekeepers when you just have this amazing project that you want to do, right? So not easy conversations, but essential ones.
Well, thank you all so much for this fabulous panel. Is there anything else anyone would like to add before we transition to our next session? Yes, just a round of applause. Thank you all so much. That was really excellent.
Thank you for organizing.
Yes.
Yes, our pleasure.
Thank you.